This is Ozarks at Large for the first day of May 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Fayetteville Foam Fest will be held this Saturday, May 4th, from 5 until 8 p.m. in the Walton Arts Center parking lot in Fayetteville. This Feed Fayetteville fundraiser will feature beers and tastings from over 50 breweries, food, and more. Tickets and more information available online at FayettevilleFoamFest.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, now that the legislative session has ended, Roby Brock talks with Rex Nelson about how the session went. Also, this weekend is jam-packed with events, including a writer's workshop hosted by the executive producer of Tales from the South, and Daniel Hintz from downtown Bentonville discusses First Friday and more.
But first, the projected cost of a list of street improvement projects in Springdale is more than officials budgeted for in a bond proposal approved by city voters last fall. Alan Pugh, chief engineer for the city, says having more projects under design than bonds would pay for is just forward thinking on the part of the city.
Well, our original budget for the projects that the CIP program is looking at was about $47.5 to $48 million. We went into the program knowing that we would have, at least under design, more projects than the bond program would entirely pay for. That was mainly due to the fact if we do have a project that goes under budget or something like that, we certainly don't want to leave any of that bond money left on the table. So by getting more projects under design, that allows us a little bit more flexibility with that overall bond money. But today's bond estimates are right around $49 million.
If that projection holds, it puts bond projects over budget by about $3.6 million. Pugh says there are a couple of options that could be pursued to balance out the projects, which include improvements to the Don Tyson Parkway, 56th Street, and Elm Springs Road, with the available budget.
The council would have the opportunity to maybe supplement the bond program out of our capital improvement program funding, or if the estimates hold true and we are actually running quite a bit over budget, they would have the opportunity to maybe scale back that program and remove one of the projects, and that would really be up to the council as we approach bidding those projects and have a little bit better idea of the overall actual cost.
However, if it comes to eliminating a project because of a lack of funds, the council faces a difficult decision. Aldermen have listed all three of those projects as priorities.
Eureka Springs is the latest city in the region to be accredited as a National Main Street program. The Eureka Springs Downtown Network announced yesterday that the National Main Street Center has accredited the organization as a National Main Street program. Jacqueline Wolven, director of the Eureka Springs Downtown Network, says the organization had to meet several requirements before it could become accredited.
One of the things that's required is you have to have a part-time director. You need to have a complete work plan, which we have. We needed to grow our budget from that smaller, very tight budget that the Downtown Network was to, in our sense, larger budget. It has to be over $50,000, which was a big step for us, actually. And then there were just some other organizational things that needed to happen.
In addition, Wolven says the Eureka Springs Downtown Network will need to find permanent physical office space in the downtown area. She says the program's accreditation brings benefits, including more assistance and resources from the Main Street Arkansas organization.
So if we want to have small business consulting or a window design or any of the services that they offer, we're able to do that now for all of our businesses within the district at no cost at an unlimited amount. As a downtown network, we were only able to offer that four times a year, which is a huge difference. Now, when new businesses come in, we're able to give this whole toolbox of things that they can have, as opposed to piecing them out one by one.
Another benefit Wolven says comes with accreditation is the boost in reputation that comes with being affiliated with Main Street programs at the state and national levels.
The city of Bella Vista is scheduled to take over operations of the Bella Vista Library next year. This comes after a 4-1 city council decision in favor of making the library a city-managed department. Frank Anderson, the mayor of Bella Vista, says the city already provides partial support for the library, giving it about $125,000 this year. Taking control of the library will take a larger budget than that.
Total budget for the library to operate on a similar schedule to the way it operates right now would be about $260,000 or $270,000. So we're talking about doubling the input plus $10,000 or $15,000. We think we can do that on into the future and then see what we want to do There is such a thing as a library property tax that a few cities in Northwest Arkansas have passed. That would be one way to develop a revenue stream on out into the future.
Mayor Anderson says a library tax is probably 5 or 6 years from being a reality in Bella Vista. The push for the city to take over the library came out of a 7-person ad hoc committee formed to look at services currently offered in the city but provided by nonprofit organizations formed prior to Bella Vista's incorporation.
Their recommendation was that the library was struggling a little bit with its total donation policy, getting no funding from any other source, basically, and that it probably could not perpetuate itself forever. It wasn't in dire straits, was not going to collapse immediately, but probably would have difficulty in the future. They also took a look, and based on the focus groups and the input from citizens, it was something that a city our size should definitely have.
The mayor says the committee is looking at the city possibly taking over other services currently offered by nonprofits, including the Bella Vista Historical Museum and the city's animal shelter.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals were back home at Arvis Ballpark last night. The Nats shut out the Springfield Cardinals 4-0. The series against Springfield continues tonight in Springdale. The Razorback baseball team was at Baum Stadium last night. The 14th-ranked Hogs defeated Missouri State 6-3. The win puts the Razorbacks at 30-15 on the season. Arkansas returns to Southeastern Conference play Friday as they travel to Kentucky for a weekend series against the 23rd-ranked Wildcats.
30% chance of showers and thunderstorms after midnight tonight. Lows in the lower 50s in northwest Arkansas. For the Arkansas River Valley tonight, 40% chance of showers. Lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, it's a 70% chance of rain throughout the area. Highs will be from the mid-40s to lower 50s. And tomorrow night, 80% chance of showers. Lows around 40.
Lawmakers have wrapped up their session business, although they'll be back in mid-May to officially adjourn. It begs the question that with Republican rule of the legislature for the first time since Reconstruction, how did the GOP govern? Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas sat down with Rex Nelson, former communications director for Governor Mike Huckabee. He's been a student of Arkansas politics for more than 3 decades.
This was the first legislative session since Reconstruction, 138 years, that the GOP was in charge, and they had both chambers. Mm-hmm. I guess the quintessential question is, did they prove that they could govern effectively?
I think at the end, certainly the leadership in the House and the Senate did a good job of pulling enough of their members to join with Democrats to certainly govern effectively. And I think that was a big question coming in that those margins were so narrow, Republicans having 51 out of 100 House members. It was a little bigger in the Senate, obviously, but in the House, you had to wonder whether we would get anything done. In the end, we got a lot done, but it took a long time.
It did. And, you know, about halfway through the session, really the gun debate, the abortion debate seemed to be front and center. I kind of felt personally that the turning point in the session was that day that Davy Carter went down to 3 committees in the House and basically gave a halftime speech as a coach and said, "We got work to do. Yeah. Let's get to business."
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree with you more. When Speaker Carter came in and said, "Enough of this. We've got a budget to pass. We've got to deal with this Medicaid private option issue. We've got general improvement to start talking about. It is time to get focused." I think that was indeed a turning point.
Why do you think that they needed that type of rally per se? I mean, why was it a reflection, do you think, of poor leadership at that point in time? Or do you think it was this concept of, we hadn't been in charge before, we're used to lobbing the grenades and seeing what happened, and everybody kind of finding their way through these reversal of positions?
You've got a real division in the Republican Party, and it comes with when you're in the majority, sometimes you start fighting amongst yourselves, as the saying goes. And you have the more business type Republicans that focus on fiscal issues. And then you have the more social Republicans and some of the people, frankly, that were came in on the Tea Party wave. And those are very different people. I think the ideologues within the party really were controlling the echo chamber, if you were, in the first weeks of the session. I think the media was suddenly focused on it, and it took Speaker Carter finally to say it's time to focus on what a biennial session is really all about, and that's passing a state budget.
Do you think that this rift that you've described, this obviously carries on into the political repercussions of the next year, year and a half, does it not?
Oh, absolutely it does. And I think it is really, Roby, too early to tell. I wish I could sit here and tell you that Republicans either help themselves or they hurt themselves with this legislative session. I've got to sit back and watch a little bit, because on the one hand, you could say, well, the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate President Pro Tem and Michael Lamoureux, the House Speaker and Davy Carter pulled things together. They got it done at the end. Or will the Democrats, as they try to focus on the more ideological members, on some of the really out there legislation that was passed, on Nate Bell tweets and things like that, will that take the focus and will that win the day politically? For me, it's too early to tell the answer to that.
Sit back and wait, as a good political observer will do. You can at least subjectively look at this session and say, I think somebody had a good session. I think somebody could have had a better session. Who do you think maybe shone above all the others out there?
I think in the end, the speaker certainly had a good session. I think because he was able to get enough Republican votes to get the private option done over in the House, because he was able to get the tax cuts that he wanted through, I think he had a very good session, and I think that has to lead to speculation that now there probably is a greater chance at the end of the session than there was at the first of the session that maybe he jumps into that Republican gubernatorial primary and makes that a three-man race rather than a two-man race.
Well, and that's a great segue to this topic here. It's because if you look at how GOP primaries have played out over the years and where we kind of are in Arkansas now with politics and a Republican primary, I've talked to various sources who say maybe 100 to 150,000 people will, you know, take part in a Republican primary next spring. That's not a big number. If Davy Carter can be this energetic new candidate and bring new members into the party fold, does he have a chance of winning the nomination against an old hat like Asa Hutchinson?
It's a lot bigger number than it used to be. I mean, I was involved with what up to that time was the most high-profile Republican primary in history, and that was that Tommy Robinson Sheffield Nelson race, which dominated the media in this state for almost a year. And only 80,000 people ended up voting in that race. 80,000 decided it. So it's a lot bigger. I think that Carter could stand a chance, especially, and I'm going down the line, but those of us that like to play politics do that, especially if Tom Cotton gets in that Senate race against Mark Pryor. That opens up the 4th District, and you have three or four people in that race, and there are three or four Republicans that are talking about it, that are thinking about it. That could draw a bigger Republican primary turnout than usual in South Arkansas and could lessen the importance of Northwest Arkansas. That plays to the speaker if he's in the race against Asa Hutchinson.
Conversely, you've got the 4th District is Mike Ross's home base, and there's going to be some people that will want to vote in that Democratic primary for him, number one. And number two, there could be multiple Democrats get into a congressional race if that seat opens up too. So I'm still kind of not sure how that factors into this election cycle for this next year. I agree with you. It could be big dilution of the Republican vote from Northwest Arkansas, but it could also be helpful to the Democrats as well.
You know, 6 years ago, if you'd said Asa Hutchinson, he's from Northwest Arkansas, shoe in against a candidate from Central Arkansas, Curtis Coleman from Central Arkansas. If Davy Carter gets in, he's from Central Arkansas. I'm just saying Northwest Arkansas is still very important in a Republican primary, but not as important as it was 6 years ago, as more and more people get used to voting in Republican primaries in other parts of the state.
The dominant issue in this legislative session was the health care insurance expansion, the private option, as it's called. Do you think that that blunts that as an issue to bang Democrats over the head with, as Republicans have done for the last two election cycles, Obamacare, health care? now there's a Republican plan out there that has addressed this health care problem. How does that play out, do you think, in terms of an issue in the next election cycle?
It may blunt it a little bit, but I've got to tell you, in a state where Barack Obama is as unpopular as he is anywhere in the country, I still think the mere fact that he's in the White House during the 2014 election cycle benefits Republicans. We certainly saw it happen in a big way in 2010. We saw it happen again in 2012. If you're a Democrat, you had much rather be on the ballot in 2016 when there's a new president rather than 2014 when Barack Obama is still at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
That has not deterred Mike Ross from getting back into this governor's race. And we've seen he and Bill Halter they're already at each other's throats. I mean, they're a week and a half into the race already, and we are seeing, it's as if the election's next week.
I mean, Ross came out swinging a little bit out of character for him, even. And you think of Mike Ross as being a little more moderate guy. He comes out swinging. Halter, of course, is not afraid to swing. For those of us that just sit back and watch it, it's going to be a very fun race to watch. I think you have to say early on that Ross is certainly the favorite, but that's not to count out Halter. And if a fairly well-funded third person should get in, a John Burkhalter type at least, you could certainly force a runoff. And then runoffs get really crazy because it becomes all about turnout then, as you know, during that three-week runoff campaign.
All right, last question for you. We got Senator Mark Pryor up for re-election. We speculate Tom Cotton may be his first opponent there on that. Do you think that Mark Pryor is on the ropes like Blanche Lincoln was, or do you think he's in better shape than Blanche Lincoln was when she ran for re-election?
I will say this. If I had been Mark Pryor, I would have been praying back in November of last year that my party's nominee, President Obama, lost. I just think it is a terrible time to be running statewide as a Democrat with Barack Obama in the White House in Arkansas. So, yeah, I think Mark Pryor has a very tough campaign against him, regardless of who the Republican nominee is.
That was Roby Brock speaking with Rex Nelson, former communications director for Governor Mike Huckabee. You can hear more from the conversation at talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And the Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
Next Tuesday, early voting begins in Sebastian County for the countywide 1 cent sales tax. As Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, the sales tax provides support for crucial services throughout the county.
When Sebastian County voters go to the polls May 14th, it will be the second time they've been asked to reauthorize the 20-year-old penny sales tax. According to the state's Department of Finance and Administration, the county collects a 1.25% sales tax, which is far from the highest in the state. That honor goes to Hempstead and Howard counties with their 2.75% sales taxes. But what other counties do is beside the point. Last year, Sebastian County collected more than $28.5 million in sales tax revenue. The city of Fort Smith did even better, collecting more than $40 million in revenue during 2012. Comparatively speaking, the other county seat of Sebastian County in Greenwood, with its proportionately smaller population, raked in almost $2 million sales tax dollars last year. Ray Gossack is the city administrator for Fort Smith. He says that proceeds from the tax provide for a variety of public services.
And the most important of those is public safety services. In Fort Smith, 76% of our share of the tax revenue is used to provide police and fire services. And that revenue comprises more than 40% of the police and fire department budgets. So it's a very important revenue source for basic governmental services such as police and fire.
Denny Gabbard, the mayor of Greenwood, gave similar sentiments, saying that the average $1.6 million in revenue the city gets annually from the tax would make a large impact if it weren't there.
That $1.6 million goes into safety of the people, more or less. What that would boil down to is it's about 50% of that $1.6 million goes toward our police department's pay. And so we would actually probably end up losing at least, I would guess, half of the police officers that we have would have to go on furlough.
But public safety isn't the only area that would be impacted by a defeat of the tax at the ballot box. Gabbard says that the revenue supports the city's fire service and Parks and Recreation Department. David Hudson, Sebastian County judge, says that the tax is an important asset to the county and to all 11 cities within its borders.
The majority of the funds go for public safety purposes. That would include law enforcement, fire protection, and operation of the adult detention center, the jail, and the juvenile detention center, as well as other programs such as libraries, senior citizen centers, public transit. And some of the smaller cities use it for streets and other sources.
Though there hasn't been any organized opposition to reauthorizing the tax, city and county officials aren't taking any chances.
We have a citizens committee that is spearheading a voter education effort to let the public know how important this tax revenue is to all 11 cities in Sebastian County and to the county government. So there's been civic club presentations, and soon we'll be starting with newspaper advertisements and radio ads to encourage people to get out and vote in the May 14th election and to vote for continuing the countywide sales tax.
Again, the sales tax election takes place May 14th, but early ballots can be cast starting May 7th at either county clerk's office in Fort Smith or Greenwood. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Palace's fish eagle is not a bird well known to many of us here, partly because the relative of the bald eagle is found halfway across the world, partly because it is disappearing, and partly because only a handful of researchers are studying the magnificent creature. One of those researchers is Marla Steele, a doctoral student in biological sciences at the University of Arkansas.
Well, I came to the University of Arkansas in the fall of 2010, and I came into Dr. Douglas James' lab, and I knew that I wanted to do research on raptors in Asia.
As an undergraduate, she was offered and accepted an invitation to present a paper on her work about Asian raptors at the 6th annual conference of the Asian Raptor Research and Conservation Network in Mongolia.
And in Mongolia, I really hit it off with the head of the ornithology lab there, Dr. Sundev Gombobatar. And so we got to talking about his work in Mongolia. And while I had been familiar with Japan and a little bit of Thailand, I had never really even imagined what it was like in Mongolia. And next thing I know, after spending a week there with the conference, I fell in love with the country overall.
This week, Marla Steele came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about her future research plans, including an ambitious project that will be completed, she hopes, with crowdfunding. At the webpage dedicated to the effort, there is a video Marla made that includes footage of the rare bird, Indiana Jones-style graphics, and dramatic music. Marla Steele says the window for studying the palace's fish eagle is fleeting. It's believed there are fewer than 10,000 left.
Yeah, it's listed as under the IUCN Red List as globally vulnerable, which means that there could be anywhere from 1,000 to 9,999 birds. The problem is we have a deceptively large range. The bird's original range extended all the way out from the Caspian Sea to the middle of China, and then finally to southernmost Russia, all the way down to Myanmar and the Indian subcontinent in the northern section. So it has a very massive range, which makes it deceptive. And we're thinking, okay, we see 15 to 20 in Mongolia, and then we see maybe 45 breeding pairs in India, and we think the bird's fine. Mm. Next thing you know, though, when you start looking at each country, and the majority of the countries have been extirpated, they're just not there anymore.
And there's precious little known about their migratory habits, right?
Right. There's been a lot of speculation as far as, okay, we've seen the birds here during the summer, and they tend to disappear around, say, September. They can appear anywhere from April to May in Mongolia and disappear by September. And so it's obvious that they're migratory. They haven't been seen in the winter. But as to where they go, nobody knows. Same thing with India. They know they breed during the winter in India, which is complete opposite in Mongolia. And so they're here somewhere anywhere from October to March, but by March, some of them just disappear, and nobody knows where they're going. And overall, there hasn't been a single comprehensive study on the migration habits of Pallas's fish eagles.
The fact that it's listed as a vulnerable species, studying the migration habits, trying to find out more, could help it become less vulnerable? Is that the hope, the desire?
Right. As of now, the bird is declining very rapidly. And the problem is you can't conserve a species if you don't know where it's going 6 months out of the year. So aside from not knowing its migration habits, we also have no clue what its non-breeding habitat requirements are. And again, if we don't know this information, how can we possibly make a proper conservation plan to protect it?
How difficult is it to see one if they're declining and there's such a big range?
It depends on where you look. And as far as the protected national parks, like say in India, Kaziranga National Park, or even Jim Corbett National Park, which is a pretty well-known tourist destination in India, they're protected national parks, which some people, especially in Jim Corbett, they're not even allowed to get out of the Jeep. They have to stay inside the Jeep, and they are not allowed to interfere with the wildlife whatsoever. So that gives it a very nice protected habitat because they may very well be very sensitive to human disturbance. You go outside of the national parks, however, though, and it's significantly harder to find the birds. My recent field season back in India in March 2013, we were wandering all over the place in Haryana, and we saw maybe one bird. And it because of all these people running around the wetlands and the rivers, it would not come down. It would just kind of soar overhead briefly and disappear.
Do you remember the first time you saw one in the field?
Oh, yeah. I remember it very, very clearly. Of course, I'd spent hours upon hours looking at this bird and hearing sound clips of its call, but there's nothing quite like seeing it for the first time. I had gone to Jim Corbett National Park by myself and talked to some of the locals, the local birders who knew about this bird and knew who might be able to help me find it. So I hired a local guide and driver, and he took me to the top of this mountain, and we just overlooked the Kosi River, and he pointed out far in the distance. He said, "There's a nest right there in that tree." By the time I just identified the nest, very carefully nestled in between the three branches of a red silk cotton tree, I hear this wonderful yet terribly obnoxious call. If you could imagine a squeaky fishing tackle combined with the carefree call of a seagull, that would be the magnificence that is a Pallas's fish eagle right there. So I hear this call, and right there in between the valley of two mountains, it's just soaring over the river and goes directly to the nest. And to my eyes, surprise, what do I see after seeing that eagle go into the nest? But there are two chicks.
You mentioned the call. You called it sort of squeaky fishing tackle and a seagull. When we see an eagle in a movie, it's this majestic sort of cry. So what does this sound that you're describing? No, it's not what we're used to in Hollywood.
I'll tell you a secret. That majestic, just fierce cry that you hear in the majority of movies, it's not even an eagle at all. It's actually a red-tailed hawk, which is a very common hawk in North America,
yeah.
But it's not an eagle. It's a budio.
So here is the real sound of a Pallas's fish eagle collected by Matthias Richard. Marla plans to go back to further study the bird, and she has a plan to use amazing technology to track the Pallas's fish eagle's migration patterns.
My ultimate goal is, since we don't know where these birds are going, and since it has such a deceptively large range, and it's could possibly be a very long-distance migrant, we have to use the employment of satellite technology to track them. So we have GSM GPS transmitters. And what it does is it takes GPS satellites and it collects its coordinates. Depending on the battery, it can collect it every 2 to 5 minutes for 18 meters at a time with both high, both horizontal and vertical location. And it transmits that data directly to my computer through GSM cell towers. I mean, essentially, I'm getting a text message from Pallas's Fish Eagle.
Wherever you are?
Wherever I am, as far as my computer.
To that end, she has a crowdsourcing website at Indiegogo.com with different perks for different levels of contributions. For example, $5 will receive a personal thank you note, $250 a signed field sketch of the bird, and the top level, $3,600, gives somebody naming rights to an individual tracked eagle.
Right now, with our previous fundraiser, we were able to raise funds for 2 GSM units, and those units are going to go on eagles in Mongolia. But unfortunately, that only covers the northern range. And since we have 2 different distinct breeding seasons, northern population breeds in the summer and the southern population breeds in the winter, we need at least 2 units for India as well. So within the next 6 months, we're going to try and raise as much funds as we can so we can purchase those GSM units and figure out where the birds are going.
You can find a link to the website Marla has started that includes her short video at OzarksAtLarge.com. Happy May Day. It is Wednesday, May 1st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grada.
And with us is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And if I could sing, I'd break into It's May from Camelot.
I like that song.
I like our listeners too much to do that.
Okay.
So I'll just tell you about something going on tomorrow night since we're trying to work a day ahead.
Mm-hmm.
The Knox Street Book Club, a fairly new venture. I think this is the second book.
Second or third.
At the Clayton House Museum in Fort Smith. Secret Rituals and Manhood in Victorian America.
Yes. This will be led by someone from the history department at UAFS.
Exactly. Mike Crane.
Yeah.
Starts at 5 o'clock tomorrow night. Don't get a day ahead of yourself. And you can register at 783-3000.
So it's going to be talking about Freemasons, Odd Fellows, and the like.
I know a lot of Odd Fellows.
You know, capital O, capital
F. Oh, those.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So those societies that sort of peaked there in the late 19th century.
It should be a really interesting topic.
I would think so.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So you think you know it all.
From Gum Flats. Kevin, you got to know this, right? You're on Gum Flats.
What was the question? I couldn't hear it.
Oh, it was the percentage of people who never brush their dog's teeth.
Well, I'll say this. I've never done mine. no, not my teeth, but my dog's teeth.
Your dog's teeth.
Oh, heck, I'm going to say at least 90%.
That's good enough. Join me this week for fun, laughs, and the quiz on the What Do You Know Radio Hour from PRI, Public Radio International.
What Do You Know? Saturday mornings at 10 here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Still ahead on this edition of a Wednesday Ozarks at Large, Eureka Springs and Tales from the South. Details in just a few moments. And Daniel Hintz from Downtown Bentonville Incorporated gets us ready for First Friday. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. KUAF is supported by Soul Yoga Lounge, offering yoga and yogaritas this Friday, May 3rd. Yoga is 5:45 to 7 p.m. with margaritas from 7 until 9. Located on Dixon Street in front of Clubhouse Fitness in Fayetteville, more information is available at soulyogalounge.com. And KUAF is supported by Ben Owens Shelter Insurance Agency, providing auto, home, and life insurance. 582-4990 for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Among the many events packed into this busy weekend is a workshop at the Writer's Colony at Dairy Hollow in Eureka Springs. Sunday, Paula Morell, executive producer of Tales from the South, will conduct a workshop teaching participants how to write their own true tale for the show. Morell describes the storytelling radio program as an oral history project where everyday Southerners read stories they have written. June 16th, Morell and her crew will be in Eureka Springs to record an episode of the program that will feature 3 storytellers from Eureka Springs. Earlier this week, I spoke with Paula on the phone, and she began our conversation by telling me how Tales from the South came to be.
A friend of mine was doing a radio show out in California, San Francisco, and he sent a call for stories out And I'm an English professor and a writer and a restaurateur. I got his call for stories, and I sent it to my writer friends in Arkansas and got 10 good stories and passed them on to him, but then his radio show fell through. And so I had 10 really good stories on my hands, and so I literally just cold called KUAR here in Little Rock. And my whole intent was to have a one-time airing of these really good stories, and they immediately liked the idea and asked me to go ahead and start a show around it. So we started off doing once a month, and then we've been eight years on the air now. So first couple of years was pretty low key, and we've just kind of been building on it ever since. And now we're distributed and syndicated worldwide, and we have a huge listening audience, and it's just a lot of fun to see the whole thing grow.
During Sunday's workshop, one of the things you'll be teaching participants is how to write their true tale for the show. So my first question is, how do you know if you have an actual story to tell? Because sometimes you hear these amazing stories, and you sit and you're like, well, I don't have a story like that.
Well, everybody has a story to tell, and that's a big part of the project for me I get hundreds and hundreds of submissions, and I don't ever turn down stories. My goal is not to only take what I think are the best stories or the most interesting stories, because everyone has stories. Our lives are made up of stories, and we all have very interesting and a lot to say. And so for me, what the show is all about is giving people a voice. So the tricky part for some people is knowing what to write about, A, and B, how to most successfully write it and then read it in front of a live audience. And so, all those are very different steps and very different processes. But I would never say that people don't have stories. Everyone has an incredible amount of stories. Our lives are made up of them, whether they're from childhood or from, 2 days ago or happening at this moment. You know, we're a multiplicity of stories. So that the workshop is centered around really kind of helping people identify what might be interesting in their lives and then starting the process of that. The workshop won't get to the editing process, but it is about helping people to kind of see their lives as made up of all these stories and then help them to perhaps pick one or two to work on Sunday, but then, realize that their lives are just, many, many stories that are all interconnected, and that helps connect us with other people. Our individual stories help us connect to each other. So it's like a big tapestry.
And during the workshop, you're also going to teach participants how to present their stories on radio. They'll be reading, if they're on the show, they read it live. Do people need to write their stories differently than if they were just presenting it in print?
It's a different kind of animal in a lot of ways. The workshop we're just going to touch on the telling part of it, the story, the audio part of it, the oral part of it, because the work that goes into turning it into something that would be successful on a radio show comes in the editing process. And what we're really doing on Sunday is more of the creative process. They're really two different processes. And so on Sunday we're going to work on and look at how to come up with stories, how to initially get them down, but then to work on editing a story would come after the workshop. How to then, and we'll touch on it, and I'll have handouts and stuff and talk to people about how they work for the radio. But yes, it's a lot of stories can be successful both heard and read, but there are many stories that are more successful read and many that are more successful heard, So Tales kind of walks the line because we also put out books every year. And so a lot of our stories, or we try to, kind of walk that middle line with our stories. But the most important thing about our stories is the radio portion of it. So they need to be able to have a certain structure to them to be successful on the radio.
Paula Morell is the executive producer of Tales from the South, and she will conduct a workshop beginning at 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Writers' Colony at Dairy Hollow in Eureka Springs. Morrell says you do not have to attend the workshop in order to have your submission considered for an upcoming broadcast of Tales from the South that will feature Eureka Springs storytellers. Space is limited to Sunday's workshop and registration costs $25. More information is available at writerscolony.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me is Daniel Hintz, who is Executive Director of Downtown Bentonville Incorporated. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Good to be back.
We're going to talk about First Friday, which is coming up.
Yes, it is.
But this First Friday lasts Saturday and Sunday?
This is a
it's
Friday.
It's like out-of-town guests. They come and it sticks around.
Right, but this won't smell like fish after 3 days. Right. Okay, I'm telling you, this is a weekend extravaganza. And now that the farmers market is open, so many of the events that we do on those Fridays actually extend over the weekend. And we've done that through design. This particular First Friday is a partnership with the Walton Arts Center, helping them launch their regional Artisphere program. And we're very excited.
Which takes place all over the place.
And so it's neat to be one of the destinations, if you will, of that wonderful festival. Now, on that First Friday, we have all kinds of music and things, but I think one of the things that's really cool about this is First Fridays are also becoming sort of an experience that races and other partner organizations want to sort of tie onto. So that night, the Bentonville School Foundation is actually doing their Gold Rush 5K, which helps their Bold for Gold campaign. Mm-hmm. You can still sign up at goldrush5k.com. That brings down thousands of people just for the run itself, and then they get to hang out at the First Friday.
What's the course? Do you know offhand?
The course winds its way through downtown and ends back up. So it leaves the square and then kind of comes back to the square area.
Okay.
And so that starts about 6 o'clock. But it's a great event and for a great cause. But the May 1st Friday, I'm telling you, the talent we have is incredible. Carter Sampson, who is Fayetteville, Arkansas-based singer-songwriter.
She's magnificent.
Absolutely amazing. And when you look at her musical legacy and the family that she comes from, the fact that she cut her last album here at East Hall Studios mm-hmm. in Fayetteville, this is another thing that we love to do at First Fridays and other events in downtown Bentonville is not only to bring in folks from outside the area, you might not be able to hear them in any of the venues in Northwest Arkansas, but also to celebrate that amazingly deep talent that we have here in Northwest Arkansas, and Carter is definitely one of that talent. Another performer that's coming in is Jamie Stone. This is brought by the Walton Arts Center.
Some people call him the Yo-Yo Ma of the banjo.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had not heard that, but now I'm
not
even
saying everybody does, but I've honestly heard him seen a critic call him that.
I'm now even more excited to see Jamie Stone because, I mean, this is a two-time Juno-winning banjoist, and he brings in folk traditions, connecting that sort of banjo with, and Room of Wonders, which is his latest album, explores music from Norway, Sweden, Bulgaria, Brazil, Italy, and all over North America. And so, you know, you just think just those two alone at a First Friday is a veritable cornucopia of talent. But wait, there's more.
And before you tell us more, you mentioned he's won a couple of Juno Awards. That's the Canadian Grammy.
Yes.
Just so people know.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Britt Fields Band.
Also locally based. With a relatively new CD.
Yes. But I tell you, Rachel Field and Larry Brick are incredible to watch as a duo. They're absolutely fantastic. They can fill up the stage just with the two of them. And I think it's really cool. We love to have them back that evening. And then on the street during the First Friday, another partnership program with Walton Arts Center is the Dinosaur Petting Zoo.
Yeah, I want to ask you about this. Okay.
Yes.
Now, news reports have suggested dinosaurs are extinct.
Uh-huh.
So what's happening here?
Well, you've heard about the DNA things that have been going on lately.
Yes.
That is not the case here. Uh-huh. This is actually a group called Earth, which creates original live theater and sort of makes performance and live theater and puppetry. They started back in 1990. And they sort of bring stilt walkers and inflatable environments, aerial and flying creatures, all of this stuff to this really cool interactive performance. This one is all about, of course, dinosaurs. And as soon as the Walton Arts Center had mentioned to us that they wanted to bring these guys, and we took a look at their website, I mean, just it's going to be a phenomenal experience for young people and adults as well. So the Dinosaur Petting Zoo will be happening on the streets about 5:30, okay, and be going throughout the evening. So just that night alone is mind-blowing to think that we're having that level of talent on the downtown square. But once again, there's more. because on May 4th,
yes,
on May 4th, during the farmer's market, we're having Asphalt Orchestra, which is an iconoclastic 12-piece marching band. These guys do all kinds of crazy sort of inventive marching band, jazz, rock, classical sort of mixture of all kinds of things. It's a whole new element to music that I think is going to be introduced on the downtown square. It's going to be a great addition to the farmer's market.
Now, May 4th is also Trail Mix, which is part of Artisphere. It started in the morning,
right,
it's in Fayetteville, but in the afternoon, it's in Bentonville.
That is correct. That is correct. And they have a whole wide variety of musicians and performers that are actually happening on the Crystal Bridges Trail and grounds from internationally acclaimed musicians. It's a whole day long of festivities and that are free and open to the public. And you can go to either Crystal Bridges website or the Walton Arts Center website to find out the full array of performances. But if you get thirsty or you need a little bit more stimulation, if you will, on that evening or that day, we're also partnering with Mountain Bird Coffee to do a coffee tasting starting at 9 a.m. at Tuscan Trotter. It's the science behind coffee, Taste of the Americas. And it's an introduction of the world of sustainable coffee farming and roasting, connecting to the Artisphere sort of sustainability and Greenpeace. And then Chef Rob from Tuscan Trotter is going to come out and demonstrate how to cook with coffee at the farmer's market. Cook with coffee.
Meaning using coffee as ingredient or cooking things that go with coffee?
Cooking as coffee as an ingredient. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be using Mountain Bird Coffee
like
in a variety
would,
of things.
I know that you're not Rob, so you can't speak for him.
Right.
But like using it as a marinade or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at one of Tuscan Trotter's signature dishes right now on their menu is a venison that is actually sort of marinated in Mountain Bird Coffee.
Huh.
And it is absolutely gorgeous. It is really, really nice. So it's just an opportunity to look at a different way of using coffee outside of the morning.
Okay, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Say I have the venison that's been marinated in coffee.
Yeah.
Is that going to keep me up at night? No, I'm serious. I mean, does the caffeine, or is it like when sometimes you cook with wine or rum, mm-hmm, or something and the alcohol burns out, mm-hmm, does the caffeine burn out?
That would be a great question to ask Chef Rob on May 4th.
Okay.
But then Sunday comes around on May 5th, and Crystal Bridges, once again in partnership with Walton Arts Center, is doing a workshop exploring nature's space, Earth Art Sculpture. And you get to see the museum's landscape as a space in which to create your own temporary Earth Art Sculptures. Now, I've never knew temporary and earth art sculptures going together, but this is going to be an absolutely fascinating way to kind of see how that works. You'll actually be able to look at environmental art installations across Crystal Bridges campus by all the artists that, mm-hmm, are on the campus. And then folks can actually practice collaborative art and nature techniques to create their own earth art. And it's $45. You can register online. But that sort of really rounds out an entire weekend of wonderful partnerships between downtown Bentonville, Crystal Bridges, Walton Arts Center, all of our restaurants, retailers, that
and
kind of
then thing. Don't forget, we mentioned it last week, but don't forget the Cinco de Mayo backstage.
Yes, the Cinco de Mayo backstage. It's going to be absolutely incredible. Music by Danubio. You can buy tickets to that event by calling our office or getting information about any of these events at 479-254-0254. Just go to our website at downtownbentonville.org.
Farmers Market, now open.
Now open every Saturday. And I tell you, you got to come up and hang out with us. This is an incredible market. It's going to be a wonderful year.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The president cracks jokes for the press corps.
I've got 99 problems, and now Jay-Z's one.
Congressional candidates trade barbs in the Palmetto State. Senate primaries in Massachusetts to fill the seat of former Senator John Kerry. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, and guest host John Donvan. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. Support for KUAF comes from Pilates Plus, offering Pilates classes and equipment, bar classes, massage therapy, private instruction, and more. Information and class schedules are available at PilatesPlusNWA.com or 287-4519. The Fayetteville Foam Fest will be held this Saturday, May 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. in the Walton Art Center parking lot in Fayetteville. This Feed Fayetteville fundraiser will feature beers and tastings from more than 50 breweries, food, and more. Tickets and more information are available online at FayettevilleFoamFest.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Eagle Gap.
Where is Eagle Gap?
Eagle Gap is on County Road 97 in Polk County. It's just north, of course, of the intersection of County Road 97 and Highway 270, about 20 miles north of Mena.
Just
a little bit north of Eagleton.
Oh, so, well, there you go.
Yeah.
We have some business to take care of from yesterday.
We do. We giving away a couple of tickets to see Crow Johnson and Still at the Hill. Still on the Hill at Ozark Folkways Friday night. The dedication of their outdoor stage, which is going to be called the Crow's Nest in honor of Crow Johnson. We asked, what year did the St. Louis Fair open? Because yesterday was the anniversary of the opening of the St. Louis Fair. 1904, the correct answer. And Jim Allen is our winner.
Excellent. Well, so congratulations to Jim.
We will send your name out to Ozark Folkways. You don't have to worry about picking up the tickets here. Just go out there and have a great time and enjoy the show.
Yep. Name will be at will call.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, more to give away today.
Okay.
We have one of our, what we call a family pack, where we're giving you four Malco movie theater passes and four vouchers to a future Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball game at our best ballpark.
Okay.
And again, the way the vouchers work is you walk up and exchange them, and if there are tickets available for that night,
right,
you get tickets. So it's not for any specific date.
Nope.
But be aware that in case it's a sellout.
Sure.
Okay. So four movie passes to any Malco movie theater, four vouchers to a future this season Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball game.
Okay. Well, how can the listeners win this family pack?
Well, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Today is May 1st, May Day.
It is.
It's also Law Day.
Law Day?
Law Day. Across the country, we celebrate legal matters and the law.
I did not know this.
Well, it is. It's Law Day.
Okay.
Now, the most famous fictional lawyer, arguably, is Perry Mason. And on television, Perry Mason was portrayed, of course, by Raymond Burr in more than 270 episodes during the iconic television series. He later came back for nearly 30 television movies afterwards. So 300 cases.
30 movies, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So nearly 300 cases that Raymond Burr, as Perry Mason, was involved in on television.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you three of the cases that he was involved in, and you tell me what these three have in common.
What they have in common.
Yes. They are the case of the witless witness, the case of the deadly verdict, and the case of the terrified typist. Again, the case of the witless witness, the case of the deadly verdict, and the case of the terrified typist.
That is a Kyle Kellum's trivia question, if ever I heard one.
And that's a hint.
That's a hint.
Right there.
Okay.
Because why would I care about those? Because I have a very trivial mind.
You do.
Those three cases. And really, only those three cases have this thing in common.
Okay. So if you know the answer, or if you find the answer,
right,
you can email it to us at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. And you have until tomorrow's show to figure it out, or just let us know. And we'll put all of the names into the ceramic cow and draw a winner.
You know what? And this is one where you can guess. You don't have to have seen the episodes. Think about it. Just send a guess. You don't have to know the right answer. Just take a shot.
Okay.
All right.
Again, ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
Yes.
Good deal.
And happy Law Day.
Happy Law Day. Happy May Day, happy Law Day, all the things.
I know that at some point this afternoon, you're going to try a fair delicacy.
I am. They're having kind of a carnival at the University of Arkansas, and I hear there are fried Snickers, so it's my mission to go find it.
Okay. Take your cardiologist with you.
Sure.
Fried Snickers. And hopefully we'll get a report. You're not on the show tomorrow, but Friday.
Well, I will let you know.
We'll find out how it tastes.
I will let you know. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition edition of Ozarks at Large. Kyle will be back along with his host, Christina Thomas.